Hey,
Yeah, I have.
I've not sort of anything in the tech channel. Sorry about
That's all right.
word. I'm picking up from what you're saying is that the whole thing's a sort of great fudge. It's more of a way of appealing to prejudice, to nationalism, anything else, and that. In reality, in practice, not a lot is going to change on the ground, as they say. It's people are going to come in from abroad to work here, not exactly as they want, but very much as they were doing before. And okay, if there are occasions when the government really wants to kick one out, they'll be able to appeal to this new law. But a lot of the time, to say not a great deal is going to change. Is that a reasonable perception? That's what I've
Yeah, I
picked
mean,
up.
I think that's exactly right, Howard. I think, and I mean, you can only guess, you know, the sort of chaos that's going on really in the government. But my guess is that, you know, this was a flagship policy. This, you know, this was flogged to death over the Brexit Leave campaign. And Priti Patel, you know, is determined to push it through. I wouldn't be surprised, a lot of civil service advisors, a lot of Tory MPs probably said, don't do it now, you know, don't put it in now. It's just going to be shooting ourselves in the foot because we're relying on these foreign workers. And I think she sort of, you know, brushed everyone aside and said, you know, you bugger off, I'm going to do it. But at the same time, it is just political posturing because, you know, you've got a bill that says, as I say, nothing, nothing. And so the press reports and media reports are picking up these advisory committee things that not law at all. And Priti Patel will have, through these regulations, complete discretion as to how to frame that point system, what criteria, what exemptions, what special categories, what numbers, agricultural workers. And so I think, you know, they'll get the political headlines, but even that is pretty crass because you think, well, I'm not sure there's a lot of political, you know, capital in this sort of immigrant bashing at this point. But I think she was just determined to do it, and I think she just is pushing forward. Yeah, but no, I don't think we're going to see anything drastic happen. I mean, what we have seen, as I say, from the stats, is that because of the Brexit and because of the anti-immigration stuff, a lot of the people have gone home. A lot of these Europeans have gone home, and so the net EU migration has dropped, you know, massively.
We got three people in the question queue, so Carla's got a question to start with.
Oh, I didn't see that. Sorry. Yeah,
Hi.
Carla.
First of all, I'd say if I wouldn't mind chairing if it needs be, but I just wanted to follow on from Howard because that was my impression. My impression, well, a question to you, Tim. Do you think that this is just to appease the Brexiteers? And as Howard says, and I think you're saying, that nothing much is going to change?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, Carla. I think that's it. So we get a few headlines. We've already seen massive drop in net EU migration, you know, from 250,000 5 years ago to 49,000 last year. So they'll be crowing about how they've been successful. You know, they won't bother to say what we didn't bring until 2021. And I think, you know, that'll be it. And a lot of the major employers are making a big fuss about it because,
Yeah, and
you
yeah, and the British
know,
public don't bother to do their research, do they? They don't
yeah.
bother
No,
to
that's
find out.
fine.
You know, they really don't bother.
No.
Okay, thanks. Thanks. Very interesting, Tim, what you were saying. Just a little thing before I put my question to you is that Nala here. We've seen all the time, or hearing all the time, about people just coming over and not stealing our jobs because there are no jobs or very few jobs up here. And they're talking, they're looking at the people that are coming over, basically signing on the Nash. You know, This is a big impression. Of course, nobody's got any numbers. It's something that they've heard from the brother and his friend, all that. So it has got an effect in depressed areas. You know, I don't think we should deny that. You said that you don't see much political impact of what Patel's doing. These sorts of people that are seeing immigrants as a threat. Not black people anymore. It's Hungarians and it's whatever. The point I want to make is, have you seen any sort of evidence for the resistance to Patel? What are they basing the resistance on? Is it that they're representing these multinational companies, or is it people that have sort of seen the light when it comes down to demographic changes, the reduction in the number of young people in UK and Europe?
I mean, on the first point, Steve. Yeah, I mean, I think traditionally, and you know, like a few months ago, there would have been political capital in this, you know, in this sort of express train that's been anti-immigrant express train that's been, you know, driving the Tories and a lot of the Brexit process. But I think now I don't think there's a lot of political kudos apart from hardline, you know, anti-immigrant racist people, because there's been so much about foreign nationals keeping the country going, you know. So that's what I was trying, you know, I was just saying that the timing was such a bad timing because all the soft anti-immigrant people, I think, will have will be pretty quiet or may have changed their view to some extent, you know, when they've been being treated by black, Asian, you know, where the cleaners are Polish and so on and so on, and so the delivery drivers are East European and so on and so on. So that was. I don't think there's a lot of political kudos at the at the moment in terms of the taking jobs thing. Yeah, that's always been the mantra, hasn't it? That you're taking UK jobs. There was an interesting report, and then people saw it on the TV the other night, where they were talking about the crop harvesters coming over from Eastern Europe. It surprised me that they're still coming over, you know. But anyway, they're still flying in, not so many of them, but they're still flying in. But they interviewed one of the employers, and the report said thousands of people have applied online through Fit for Britain, UK people, and very few had been employed. And they've not got through the agents, all done by through recruitment agencies. So employer was asked, have you recruited any UK workers? And he said, yeah. He said, in the last 4 weeks, I've taken 31 through various agencies in the Fit for Britain. And the reporter said, well, how many people How many of those are still working? He said none. They're not one of the 31 took the job for 4 weeks. And then the employer said, well, it's a hard job. We didn't do it. Yeah, so I'm not sure UK workers in reality will be, you know, queuing up to pick crops. I did potato picking once. It's hard work. Sorry, Steve. I missed your second point about democracy, didn't I? Yeah.
No. Sorry, can I come back? Can I come back, Carla? Well, I didn't say democracy. I said the demography change, the changing age ratios in the population.
Yeah. Well, we're all getting older and decrepit, aren't we, in the West, especially in the UK, especially here in Swansea. Yeah, I mean, you know, Germany's, you know, if this is the point you're making, I'm not quite sure. But for example, Germany, you remember, took 1.2 million during the Syrian war, refugees. And that caused a lot of fuss amongst AfD and some of the right-wing political groups in Germany. But that policy was a deliberate policy. because they could see their age profile of their working population was getting skewing to such an old age. They were going to be short of people. And, you know, I don't know how they're getting on now, but they seem to have assimilated, as they did with East Germany, assimilated that 1.2 million. I mean, I dare say there are still problems. But, yeah, and we've, you know, the whole of the Western world has got the same issue. So, you know, people, you know, if you had any sensible politics, you know, apart from, you know, moral issues and aspects of socialism from our point of view, you know, it's a self-interest thing, isn't it? You know, we need workers, you know, and you know, whilst, you know, I would sort of consider doing crop picking, but I know that, you know, within one or two days I'd be finished. You know, I couldn't do it at my age. You know, you need young people, and we don't have those young people. And additionally, we don't have the young people that would be willing to do it nowadays.
Okay.
If I can come quickly back. I was actually wondering whether you'd actually got any evidence, you know, like caught some capitalists or some Tory caught in the act saying, we've got to get these people in because otherwise we're not going to have any workers in another 30 years' time. If not, okay, you didn't. Okay.
No, I haven't got any direct quotes or anything, apart from that employer that I saw on the news the other day. But I know a lot of Tory MPs and a lot of employers have lobbied Priti Patel to water down the things. And I think what she said is, you know, don't make a fuss. We're only just political headlining, and I'll sort it out quietly later in the year. That'd be my guess.
Okay, comrades that would like to ask a question. Mike Foster.
Hello there. Thanks. Yeah, and thanks for the interesting talk so far. There was it was only in the news only a couple of days ago. Boris Johnson from that podium didn't he sort of invite EU workers back? I think specifically Italians. So you know to fill otherwise you know sort of understaffed, low paid jobs. So yeah, I think you know even Boris Johnson has. Recently said, yeah, you know, come back. But my other point was, in sort of other areas of society, especially over the last few decades, you know, prejudice has been eroded. You know, there's generally, obviously, it's still a problem, especially in America. But in some spheres of life, you know, there's less racism, less homophobia, less sexism. You know, sort of discrimination is sort of a hot topic, but on but regarding immigration, it's a perfectly acceptable to many people and also to the government to you know discriminate on grounds of nationality. Discrimination has a very real effect in its state sanctions, and it affects eligibility to benefits, eligibility to social housing. But it's not framed in terms of discrimination at all. You don't hear that word mentioned at all. And obviously, that's a very sort of loaded, emotive, charged word. So I was just wondering if you know the point can be made more in what we say about you know sort of discrimination based on nationality being an acceptable form of discrimination and see if that sort of has any legs as a way of pitching the argument. I was just wondering not just Tim but anyone's sort of views on approaching the issue from that angle.
Well, you mean Mike emphasizing that's an important aspect of discrimination? Yeah.
Well, just it's a sort of in some ways it's a very blatant form of discrimination, but it's not talked about as if it's discrimination, if you see what I mean. Because whereas you know discrimination based on you know gender, sexuality is something that's much more sort of sensitive, and there's some progress on eroding.
Yeah, I suppose one of the reasons. I mean, it is illegal. It's one of the aspects in the Equality Act of 2010, but nationality or national origin is illegal to discriminate. But I suppose, you know, it's not one of those high profile things, you know, probably for a number of reasons. But one is that nationalism is so strong a nation state that is so strong, and the various things that prop that up, you know, politically, economically, and socially. But one of them is the distinction between different people in different countries, isn't that? Through national flags, through football teams, through, you know, there's an encouragement to discriminate between different people from different nation states, because capitalism is, you know, one of the fundamental sort of structural aspects kind of capitalism is the nation state, isn't it? So I suppose that's one of the reasons they wouldn't want to elevate that in terms of debate or profile or emphasis, because it gets then people thinking about, well, maybe we're not so different, you know, and why do we need that nation state? And why do we need, you know, to keep killing each other and so on and so on and so on?
Come back on that, Mike.
No, that's fine. Thanks. Yeah, I think, okay. Yeah, they just put it very well, Tim. Thank you.
Okay, Dougie.
Yeah, I was just going to mention what you've been talking about, that Germany encouraged young people to come and work there because they've got an aging population. I mean, I was on holiday in Tenerife and there was a few Germans there, and they were very anti-Merkel and all that, and anti-immigration. And I tried to point out to them, you know, these young people are going to be doing jobs to pay for their pensions, you know, because they were quite elderly Germans I was talking to. I don't think I convinced them really, you know, but that's all I was going to say. I mean, one part I'd like to ask, do you think it'll do much to change the numbers of people coming into the country, or do you think things will be much the same? Because you still need the workers in care homes and agriculture, you know, for what they call low-skilled workers, you know, and British workers just don't want their agriculture jobs, right? That's all that. That thing with the 31 British workers that just gave up, you know, because the job was too hard for picking vegetables or whatever.
Yeah, well, I think the pretty detail's just, you know, completely out of step, really. I mean, the worry, I would think now, and we've seen the massive drop in EU net migration already, and we haven't even put any, you know, so-called immigration controls in on them. I think, you know, I think the worry for employers is as you say, Dougie, you know, the fact they're not, you know, not going to get the workers in. But again, I don't think that's going to be a problem, because I think, you know, political posturing and employers will get their way, and the framework of the detailed regulations will allow that to happen.
Okay, Steve.
Thanks, Carla. I just want to come back to the previous discussion with Mike. Go along with everything you said. What we need to do, of course, is to remind these people that are so patriotic, so nationalist, put the flag, is that any capitalist can just come into the country, and they've got several million quid's worth of capital to invest. So the this thing about being British is fine for the workers. Any sort of stray capitalist who needs to get out of the place quite quickly, is just able to do so, and they get exactly what the lifestyle that they require in England. Unlike the people that come in for because they're poor. It's a class issue that we need to put forward to workers.
I think that you know, that wider perspective is important in the immigration debate, especially, you know, in respect to the UK coming out of the posing coming out finally of the EU. I mean, the fundamental pillars of the European Union, and this was argued as over the years, different nation states as it developed. But I mean, it's free movement of capital. And because of the emphasis that many countries put on the free movement of capital, other countries were saying, well, we must have free movement of labour as well. And so what we're going to have, if we have at all any more restrictions on immigration, is we're going to have less free movement of people, but we'll still have free movement of capital. So we'll still have those, you know, those transnationals, you know, striding around the world, going wherever they want, whatever country, and the people will not have the, you know, freedom now as East Europeans do to come from Romania, you know, where they might own 100 or 200 a month, to, you know, to the UK, rather than maybe 800 or 900 a month. So it's and that doesn't get discussed in this context now. That was always an important point in the pillars of the European Union. But, you know, if you're going to have free movement of capital, you should have free movement of labour. Not that within a socialist context, any of that would be.
Paddy?
I remember once having a conversation with this guy who'd, I think he was a roofer, and he said he couldn't get work because all these Polish people were coming over and doing roofing for a third of the price under the minimum wage, and he seemed quite pissed off about that. And I thought, well, and he said everybody in my trade's having the same problem. None of us can get work because of this. You know, there's a big problem with that. And I think it was certainly true that in certain trades, they were getting undercut. Usually in the manual kind of trades, where knowledge of the local language wasn't such an issue. So the sort of opposition to this kind of so-called working class racism generally came from middle class people, culturally middle class people, whose jobs weren't under threat and who couldn't see this happening. But with a lot of people I knew, they were facing a real situation. But I mean, they didn't particularly necessarily blame the Polish people or the Romanian people, or when they did, I said to them, well, you know, like just imagine it the other way around for a minute, that Romania was a rich country and Britain was a poor country. Not quite so hard to imagine nowadays. I said, supposing you're doing roofing in this country and you can get 200 quid a week, but if you go over to Romania, you could get 1,000 quid a week. What would you do? And they went, oh, well, I suppose I'd go to Romania. So I said, exactly. And what would all your mates do? Oh, well, I suppose they'd all go to Romania as well. Exactly. So you'd have a whole load of anti-British Romanians banging on about these bloody British foreigners who are coming in stealing all our jobs. But you're just doing the sensible thing for you. And he said, and they said, oh, well, I suppose so, yeah, if you put it like that. So, I mean, they could easily see, you know, once you put it to them, that, you know, the Polish people and the Romanian people were just doing the sensible thing. So it seemed quite easy to then move them off the sort of subject of, you know, the area of casual racism onto a consideration of the economic system itself. Not that I made any socialist converts, I hasten to add. Anyway, that was just a quick point.
The point about whether a good way to run the system or not. I mean, in the longer term, counterproductive for capitalism, not to, you sort of said this a minute ago, Tim, but just to sort of insist on that a bit, counterproductive to capitalism not to actually allow free movement of labour, as well as free movement ideas and free movement of capital. That's the long-term trend of capitalism. That's the way it can make itself most profitable. Those terms, what's happening here, this sort of petty nationalism, this sort of pandering to xenophobia, could be seen as a bit of a blip, a bit of a short-term thing, which happening because there are all sorts of ups and downs in capitalism, but the long-term trend is, or should be, a somewhat different one. It sort of has been, if you look at the history of the system. So, you know, perhaps we shouldn't be too pessimistic about this kind of thing. Perhaps we should try and see it in a broader or long-term context.
In principle, I think that's right. But there was a lot of opposition, wasn't there, over the years when they discussed these issues, these fundamental issues of the EU. And I suppose One, you know, I mean, there's so many factors, and you'd have to sort of weight them, really. But I suppose counter to that, again, is the nationalism thing, isn't it? Because if you allow, as the EU have done, and deliberately so, free movement of labour, then that seems to me part of the reason for that was the strategy of integration. So it was to break down nation states, you know, and that was you know, and still is the agenda of a number of EU countries, France and Germany particularly. You know, they wanted full political and economic integration, which basically is one of, you know, the argument of the UK coming out was to recover its nationhood. And so free movement of labour waters that down, doesn't it? Economically and politically, you know, because it integrates people. You can't have absolute hostility to people if they're so integrated, and it waters down nation states, and nation states and nationalism is on the resurgence. I think that political dimension is important. The economic transnational companies may not be bothered about it, you know, but I think politically, because of the nationalism.
Can I take you up on that, Tim?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. It's not so much that. It was that whole getting rid of nation states thing. I see that rather as a smokescreen for sort of like anti-worker, anti-union activity. So you had things like, because the big cases, the international, the European court cases to do with like workers' rights, like the main thing was against the Siemens Union. I guess we're all familiar with that one, aren't we? I mean, basically what happened was that they changed the flag of convenience from a Scandinavian country to a Balkan company, which meant that all the sort of like all the rights that Scandinavians have, which were a lot more than the Balkans, they lost it all. And the unions were saying, we just can't take it out of the flag and do that, you know, where we lose all the rights. But the argument was, free movement of labour. And so, you know, the workers, the maritime workers just suffered from that. And, you know, it was a sort of like pro-business, anti-union thing. Similarly, there was a business that was taken up in Britain, a building company. It was taken over by a Croatian company. And again, all the sort of like rights that they had from Britain suddenly got lost. And the pay rates changed, and that when people tried to do something about it, it was, oh no, it's free movement of labour. I think that was the main thing that the European community had against behind the story of free movement of labour, that we're all one Europe, and that what was actually going on was erosion of working class rights by taking it down to the lowest common denominator. New Labour, of course, didn't do this. They were all suckered into it, and there were only sort of like a few voices, that were pointing these out. Everyone else seemed to think that the European community was such a great thing for working people, you know. And there were lots of problems with it.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think, as I said, it's such a multifaceted thing, isn't it? You can pitch and, you know, from your point of view, Vin and Howard and so on, but all of which, you know, I agree with. And the balance of the weight to give all these factors is very difficult. It's a complicated process, really. A bit like the old COVID at the moment, it's difficult. But, you know, there's different aspects. But I think, you know, all of them, all the points are valid. It's just a matter of what, you know, what weight you give them in the overall sort of melting pot of the argument, and that depends. Yeah.
Well, I think the ones that matter to a to an organisation like the European Union are the ones that benefit capital.
Yes, but even to that extent, you know, and I'd agree with that. But even, you know, as we've seen, well, in the past, but especially now, you know, over the Brexit, for example, you know, it wasn't straightforward, and there was a lot of representatives of capitalism that are for Brexit and a lot against Brexit. There's, you know, a lot of big backers on both sides, and I think it's the same with a lot of these other things as well. You know, capitalism, you know, I don't see capitalism as like, you know, with its operation, a homogenous thing, you know. Just as, you know, if you said about the labor movement, it's not a homogenous thing, you know, and factions of the labor movement are always arguing and going against each other's interests, aren't they? And so too, I think that is with capitalist operations as well.
Yeah, I think it was Dougie a while back who wondered if the changes of the law will lead to a reduction of people coming in, and I'm guessing it will. But I think one thing it might also affect is sort of the way people coming into the country do so, and by that I mean. Well, I don't know if the foreign nationals I meet in my line of work are sort of representative overall. I'm not sure if they are. That's people who are sort of approached for councils for housing problems. But most of the EU citizens I meet in that way were originally refugees from Africa or the Middle East who claimed asylum in European countries. It tends to be the Netherlands and Sweden being the most frequently ones I've seen, and then they've gained, say Dutch citizenship. So they're EU citizens, having originally been refugees, and then they've come into Britain as Dutch citizens rather than as refugees. And of course, you get sort of refugees who come in through the asylum route, and I don't think that's being affected at all by these changes. So it's possible you might get more people coming in as refugees applying directly to Britain as refugees rather than doing so in another country, gaining European citizenship and then coming to Britain. So it might sort of change sort of the route or the nature. You don't get refugees claiming asylum in Eastern European countries. I've never seen that, and I don't think that would be I don't think they'd be welcomed by many of the European governments, especially Hungary. Citizens from with Eastern European nationality, they tend to come in and have a very that's a bit of a generalisation, but it seems to be true, a very sort of a regimented work ethic, you know, more than most indigenous British people. So, yeah, I suppose I'm rambling a bit now, but I suppose my point was, yeah, it'll change the nature of immigration, not necessarily the numbers, when the future rules all come into effect.
Yeah, I remember watching Vince Cable talking to the CBI, and he basically argued that he wanted Britain to be a low-wage economy, you know, and high profit for the companies or whatever. So, I mean, will there be any effect on wages if they have a stricter immigration thing in some of the low-paid jobs like care workers and people who work in agriculture and things? But will they have to pay more to get people to come in or to fly in from European countries or whatever? I just wondered if it might have an effect on that.
Tim, do you want to come back on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think potentially it would, but I think, you know, because these provisions are not going to really bite much, and what gets done will be watered down anyway. I think it's probably not going to be, and certainly it would be a sensitive thing for employers if they find their wage bills going off. So I think it probably won't have much effect in reality. I mean, it's interesting what Mike says about the you know, the asylum immigration things, because Priti Patel put a comment in her speech on this, which said that the asylum and border crossing checks are outside of the points-based system. However, they will remain integral to the transformation of the UK's new immigration system. And I suppose, you know, if they can't, you know, maintain the anti-immigration stance in the light of the COVID thing and so on, then I think they could ring-fence the asylum refugee thing and make a lot of political capital out of that, because, you know, it doesn't have the same, you know, same sort of support amongst the public. In fact, the reverse. And the media certainly made a big headline the other week, didn't they? That little boat bobbing around in the channel and saying the border agency was saying it's a threat to our national security. And Farage got on the TV and said that it was disgraceful that it wasn't being covered by headline news. I think the, you know, the asylum refugee bashing is still, you know, still fair game, really. And one other thing about that actually is that the politicians are very upset about the judiciary and the way in which they frustrated their attempts to cut back on asylum rights, and that's been going on for years and years. Started with Blair and Plunkett when they were trying to stop judges having being able to review asylum cases and so on, and so Blair and Plunkett and everyone since, you know, when they've tried to cut down on human rights of asylum refugees, the judges have intervened using the Human Rights Act. So I think you know, because that you know, that's under threat as well. I think the politicians would like, you know, to hammer the asylum refugee. And I don't see there's any political disadvantage in that, and it wouldn't get a backlash from the public. I think they're still going to get into trouble.
Tim, just a comment. I've been reading about poverty and the effects of lockdown over the world, and I didn't realise this as much, but across the world, 1 in 9 people are supported by money sent home by migrant workers. 1 in 9 people across the world. That's a hell of a lot. So can you imagine what's happening now when migrant workers have had to go home, for instance, in India, back to their villages, etc., etc.? And the other thing is the Polish family. We had a Polish family living next door to us. Nice family, just got a new baby. They haven't heard from them, haven't seen them since before lockdown started. So we're assuming that they didn't want to be here, obviously, if there was no work, and they've gone back to Poland.
Yeah. I think of all the East European, all the EU states, Poland, the repatriation of workers from UK back to their home country, Poland, has been the most, actually. I don't know what the numbers are, but it's been substantial. Yes, I think that is the case. I mean, I think on the you know, the point of you know, hardship, you know, I mean, I think the COVID fact has had a massive, and continues to have a massive impact, doesn't it? Disproportionate impact on low-paid workers, unpaid workers, and, you know, the poor and working class generally.
Yeah. Mike, do you want to come in?
Earlier, Carly, you asked for anecdotes, so here's one. With my previous job, I took face-to-face homeless inquiries, so people coming into the council office saying they were homeless, and usually whether or not the council can provide temporary accommodation if they've got nowhere else to go, and that's tested according to, you know, several criteria. And I remember on the same day a while back, it was sort of one of those days where you know, everyone seemed to be a bit more angry than usual. Maybe it was a full moon or something. One of the people I saw, you know, single single sort of a British man came in. He unfortunately didn't fit the criteria for emergency accommodation, so I had to say, you know, sorry, we can't help. And he stood up angrily and said, oh, you know, I bet if I was a foreigner, you'd be able to help me, and then stormed off. And then, yeah, I don't know if it was the next person I saw or a bit further on down the day, it was a single Polish man who came in homeless on the night, didn't meet the criteria, got a bit angry, stormed out, and then he says, oh, I bet if I was English, you'd be able to help. So I got it from both directions on that day. So I'm not quite sure what point that makes or proves, other than in some ways that it sort of cuts across nationality if you don't fit other criteria, if you don't fit into other pigeonholes. But I suppose also xenophobia cuts across nationalities as well. I don't know. I'm not quite sure what the point was there, but I just thought I'd share that.
It's a blame game, isn't it? It's a blame game. People are blaming everyone else. It's instead of the real culprits, you know, which are the ruling class.
There's a question now. From, I was just wondering, Carla, if the questions, if the questions were to dry out, I've just got a question that I was going to, you know, if we had time in the last few minutes, discussion question, just pose. I was going to paste it in. But anyway, you've got other questions down yet.
Yeah, Tim, can you just take a couple more? So, right, so we've got Adam. Adam?
Yeah, okay. Of course, free movement works both ways. In fact, there still is free movement between Britain and Europe. It doesn't stop until the 31st of December. But after the 31st of December, there'll be these immigration controls. But it'll also mean that workers from Britain can't travel to the rest of Europe to work. There's a thing in the paper the other day. There's a record of people now going over to work in English people going over to work in Germany, because if they're in Germany after the 31st of December, they'll be able to move to other European countries. So, as I say, the thing doesn't come in. Free movement doesn't end until till the 31st of December. So there still could be a surge of people from Europe before the end of the year, because they can continue to work for 5 years and then claim permanent residence status. I was just wondering whether these restrictions, which Priti Patel has put on about having to quarantine if you come, is designed to stop people doing this. I mean, you know, to stop a surge of Europeans coming in before the deadline of the 31st of December. I would still say that, as a general principle, you know, this was the only advantage I can think of the common market, that was the free movement of labour. People can still come into Britain now, but it'll be all sorts of bureaucratic thing, having to meet all these criteria. So that'll stop people moving into Britain. But on the other hand, it'll stop British people moving out of Britain to work in Europe. So that's just a contribution to the discussion.
Steve? Yeah, I mean, Tim.
Oh, so well, I mean, I agree. I mean, I don't want you. But having said that, when you begin to realize, as Alan's suggesting, that, you know, the practical constraints that are going to occur for all of us, to a lesser extent to other Europeans who find it more difficult to come to the UK. You know, I think it is undoubtedly regressive in that sense. You know, I think and even living, you know, not working, but in living in these different countries, we still don't know quite how that's going to, you know, what's going to occur with that, and so on and so on. Yeah, I think it's in a regressive process.
No, so I agree, it's regressive. So Steve can have his.
If we're sharing anecdotes, This is a message. I'm just going to put a message up from the. I've only put the main part of this message that I received from one of the people that I work for today, because I'm a freelancer. And this chap is the. This is something that was sent to me today by the chief executive officer of Lionbridge. You may not have heard of them, but they're a huge transnational company. And he's responded to what's going on in the States at the moment. You know, so it's slight sort of ties in with this because it's about racism. This is the type of attitude that the progressive capitalist class are taking. Carl,
Steve, would you like to read it or shall I?
Would you mind? Because you've got a lovely speaking voice. But I'd just start in the second paragraph. The other's bollocks.
Okie doke. The last several days have been incredibly painful. In the midst of a pandemic that has taken 107,000 lives and 40 million jobs in the US and many more across the globe, we have witnessed the brutal murder of George Floyd. The Lionbridge community is outraged by what happened to George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and the countless others who came before them, whose lives were unjustly taken because of the colour of their skin. We reject all forms of racism and prejudice. There is no place for that in our community. Black lives matter.
Oh, make of that what you will. I just put that up there for families to see that the ruling class is, or the capitalist class is, taking an active part in pushing this idea that if we all pull together, it'll be fine. That's all.
I think that's the classic position, isn't it? That's the archetypal position because you know, it embraces this you know, Black Lives Matter and anti-racism rhetoric. But you know, when you look at what the rioters on the streets and the protests on the streets, there's very many white people there as well, and they're not just protesting against Black lives being lost. I mean, it's a class issue, and so this kind of posturing on anti-racism, you know, disguises the fact that, you know, it's a class issue, and of course they don't want to talk about that at all, you know, and so they're not that unhappy to stand up against racism because it avoids
the
class issue.
Well, in actual fact, through the church, in actual fact, it's not that they're embracing racism to avoid things. They've got to, because they need to have the largest working class available for exploitation as they possibly can. It's not because they're nice. It's because of the economic needs of the system. As I'm sure you already know, Tim, I don't need to tell you that.
Yeah, they're all workers. Yeah, they're all.
Anyone else like to put chip in? Tim, you were going to say.
We've only got a few minutes, but I've just got this question that I was sort of, you know, mulling over in this context. I've just put in the on the message board.
Steve, while Tim is typing.
No, it's in there. It's in there.
Oh, is it? No.
Oh, sorry.
It's not. Do you need to send it? That's it.
Sorry about that.
That's okay. So, in socialism, in the absence of nation states, political or geographic borders allowing free movement of people, therefore rendering the concept of immigration redundant. And in the absence of coercive law, how would such a society deal with a pandemic? Oh, blimey.
So, you know, if we're in socialism now, you know, how would we deal with it? So there wouldn't be any nation states, there wouldn't be any geographic borders, and we would have coercive law.
Well, can I just pop in there? Well, it certainly wouldn't be as bad, because we wouldn't have a whole substrata, subclass of people that were poor, malnourished, and would easily suffer more than a real healthy human would with such a pandemic. So I don't think it would be half as bad. And also, we wouldn't have the lack of PPE. That wouldn't happen. You know, we would be totally equipped because we're not dealing with money. We're not dealing with, I don't think if it, obviously we can't stop that happening, but I don't think it would be half as bad. Anyone else?
Adam, do you want to?
Yeah, Adam. Adam said there will still be islands.
Well, you still might want to stop diseases spreading from the mainland to an island, and you could, I don't see why under those circumstances you couldn't stop the free movement of people in socialism even.
Yeah. I like Adam's idea of reintroducing leper colonies. I think, Tim, what I would do is I'd get some virologists and get some scientists on the bloody issue. I don't think we could comment about anything like this, apart from what Carla says. we can, as a society, prepare and make sure that we've got the materials that we need. There won't be that constraint of profit preventing us from mothballing whatever we need for this type of thing. Of course, there will be more chance to control, because why do people keep travelling? Why do people keep? All right, I know we don't necessarily want to restrict people's movement in a socialist society. But hang on, all this business travel that's going on, you know, you'll notice that it's in the hubs where people travel to China, they travel to Frankfurt, from Frankfurt on business, from Frankfurt they travel to Schiphol, from there to Heathrow. It appears like it's not real. I mean, it's got to Brazil, but there's quite a few parts of South America, for example, that it's not really got to, because it's not on the travel, it's not on the business travel hubs. And the people that took it, Brazil, can more or less bet your shit on the fact that they were wealthy people who travelled to Europe and they've gone back and bloody infected everybody. So, Brazil, this virus was definitely taken on a class issue. As a rant.
Vin?
Yeah, I mean, rather than a leper colony, I mean, it might be something like Aum, the village that self-isolated during the plague. But I remember seeing a tweet from a doctor in India who just says, well, look, you know, coronavirus is a disease that's been spread by the rich and the brunt of it is by the poor. I would think, and what can we say about what life's going to be like under socialism? But I would say that there's going to be more chance of, you know, more people meeting up, more opportunities to travel, whether people would or not. So I think it's more of a case that this is something that we've got to be aware of, that's you know, that you have to be prepared for, really. I imagine there's going to be a few other things that'll come out of nowhere once we've got past this prehistoric stage and into socialism.
What's caused the pandemic? Capitalism's caused the pandemic, hasn't it? The drive for, the need for people to make a living, the need for poor people to make a living, but above all, the drive for profit. That's what's caused the pandemic. There's no way it would have happened otherwise. It happened in this wet market in China, and you know, you get them all over the Far East, etc. You blame the individuals who are involved in that horrible business. They probably can't, actually. A lot of them are probably poor themselves. But basically, the pandemic, an outgrowth of capitalism. And okay, I'm not saying that such a thing couldn't possibly happen in a far healthier socialist society, but hell of a lot less likely. And it's a hell of a lot more likely that if people thought it were likely to happen, they would have plans in place to cope with it, which, of course, capitalism didn't, because capitalism tries to run things on the cheap if it can for purposes of profit-making. That's the way I would sort of frame this question anyway.
Paddy, do you want to come in on that?
I was actually going to come in on a different point, but seeing as this has come up, I actually wrote about this just very recently, thinking in the Standard. One of the main problems with pandemics is packing people close together and packing animals close together. So that has consequences for how socialism would operate. It seemed to me that we would want to rethink the idea of packing people intensively into big cities with loads and loads of empty countryside. That's a recipe for a pandemic right there. And of course, intensive farming. That's where most of the SARS started and MERS started. Because of intensive farming, because viruses jump very easily between organisms that are very close together, whereas they tend to become less and less virulent with distance. So if you've got animals or people distributed fairly far apart, the virus tends to get weaker and weaker until it becomes just kind of another background thing. But the other question I was wanted to come back was an earlier point about how the capitalist class if it doesn't oppose something that's in its because it's in its interests, then it supports something that is in its interests. Like it, Steve was talking about Lionbridge doing some suitable virtue signalling over the racism issue that's in the news at the moment, but it's slightly more than that. There's a third case scenario for the capitalist class in their dealings with social issues, and that's where they don't care. Lots of us will remember how gay rights was a huge issue some years ago in the 1980s, 1990s. And it's pretty much sort of done with now. In most advanced capitalist countries, it's not really an issue anymore. The battle's been pretty much over. And part of the reason for that is the capitalist class couldn't really care less one way or the other. It's a bit like... capitalism tends to evolve in quite a reactive way. In fact, it's quite similar to how evolution itself works. It'll favour adaptations that help it. It'll oppose or delete adaptations that are bad for it. But it will do nothing about adaptations that make no difference to it. So with gay rights, because it makes no difference to the capitalist class one way or the other, they were quite happy to adapt to it. And there are quite a lot of things in capitalist society where you see change and you think and you might be tempted naively to think, oh, you know, that's the bosses are all in favor of this, and actually it's just because they don't care. And if politicians can seize a chance to get a few votes over an issue that doesn't really matter, then of course they'll queue up to do so. But it would be a bit simplistic to take a sort of, as it were, adaptationist view that everything that happens in capitalism must be in the interest of the ruling class, otherwise they would oppose it. No, there's a third situation, as I say, where they just don't care.
Yeah, I think that is an interesting framework to analyse things. Yeah, sorry.
Got a question from Dan Mullen. could we frame immigrants as, in quotes, economic refugees, or immigration as, in quotes, humanitarian crises? Dan, do you want to explain that?
Yeah. It's an idea I read about a little while ago. The displacement of workers by the millions could be considered as a humanitarian crisis. These people are not choosing, not really, to do this, to uproot themselves from their families and their culture and relocate somewhere else. And so immigration might kind of include this idea that people are kind of choosing to do this when they're really not. You know, the mass starvation and the need for millions to uproot themselves could be considered as a framing. Humanitarian crisis. And that's all.
Brian's going to come in on that, I think. Says both terms can be applied depending on the circumstances. Brian?
Yes, both terms can be applied. I mean, humanitarian crisis, that covers wars, famine, everything. Whereas economic migration, or economic refugees, that covers chasing the capital. Wherever capital is getting extended across the globe, you'll always find the economic refugees chasing that capital. But, you know, both terms can apply depending on the situation.
Can I just say something on that? Sorry, Brian.
Yeah, it's all right. And both terms need to apply in order to ensure that the human race survives, because without immigration, but if we're a static community, it just would not survive. Just go extinct, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think you know, these words, the words are interesting, aren't they? And they, you know, they prompt you to take a completely sort of different perspective on the whole issue, really. And of course, economic refugees, that phrase is used as disparaging and undeserving, because if you're an economic refugee, you're not, you know, you're not going to be fleeing persecution in that sense, in terms of the legal sense of asylum and so on and so on. So you don't get any of those potential legal rights. So economic refugees, you know, people use that as a disparaging phrase to say, you know, well, they're just coming for money. And I think the you know, the humanitarian crisis is another interesting use of words, because that then frames the whole process of movement again. But I think, you know, within that, Dan's making a sort of fundamental point, really, because we've been talking about immigration as if it's a right, and people are going to be restricted by Priti Patel's onerous restrictions if they ever came in. But of course, a lot of this movement is coercive, isn't it? It's economic, it's coerced. They're coerced by economics, or they're coerced for other reasons, through war and so on and so on. So, you know, it's not as if, you know, all these Polish people are coming here voluntarily. You know, most of them, you know, probably not now, but well, certainly when they first came in the early 2000s, you know, they would say, we're not staying, you know, we're just going to earn some money and going back, our own country, and so on. A lot of them haven't done that, although they've done it recently. So it's a coercive process, immigration, isn't it?
Steve?
Yeah, this is something else that we could broaden out as well. Right. Well, when we're talking about the terms of the debate, we could also talk about the scope of the debate, because it just so happens that state capitalism in Russia and China has forced massive amounts of internal migration, forcing people into the cities, forcing them to Siberia to work the mines and so on, just as state capitalism required. And so they were equally ripped away from the families. I'm sure that was coercive as well.
Yeah, I mean that's an interesting point, isn't it? Because when you talk about immigration, you're almost immediately conditioned into the mindset of nation states. Because without nation states, the notion of immigration, in ordinary terms, is not recognisable. So I think that's interesting. I think what Steve says about migration within countries, linking it with the idea of Paddy saying pandemics have caused, that's exacerbated by concentration of populations. If you take China and the whole world really, there's been a huge migration, hasn't there, into the cities, and that's because people have been forced off the land because of starvation, and then they're forced into a kind of servitude within the cities, living in slums, for poor wages and so on. Yeah, so the idea of migration within national borders almost has an important issue, really, as an important issue.
An excellent synthesis, Tim. Thank you.
Would anyone else like to contribute? Do we want to wrap this up now, Tim?
We can certainly wrap it up. It's 9:10. But I mean, in the sense of me wrapping it up, I don't think I could do that. The thing that I find most interesting is that, I looked at this for a while, yesterday with preparations and reading and so on. But the more you think about it and the more time you take, if you take the points that have come up in just the last few minutes, the more you get different perspectives, and I realise that my thinking is very much straitjacketed and conditioned by the constant propaganda that I've been subject to in the last 66 years, really. And however much I try to keep out of the way of that, by not watching mainstream media, not doing this, and trying to think a bit independently, I'm still locked into it. And so these points, widen, my thinking perspective. So thanks very much, everyone.
Thank you, Tim.